Today we're going to discuss excitations that are much more drastic, that take you well away from the ground state. And sometimes these excitations will produce a lot of heat, but sometimes they can be rather localized and stable, and they can travel as solitary waves. Specifically, we will discuss the case of a domain wall in a one-dimensional ferromagnet. And if we have time, then I will show you what happens also with vortices, examples of two-dimensional excitations. Okay, so our model of a one-dimensional ferromagnet or ferromagnetic chain will be the same as yesterday, except we will add a preference for a single direction. Let's call the direction z, and we will call that an easy axis. That is, the spins are encouraged to lie along this particular direction pointing one way or the other, and other directions are discouraged. So we will have a Lagrangian that contains the kinetic term that we derived yesterday, which endows the spins with an ability to process exchange interactions, and this anisotropy term . So z hat is a unit vector in the z direction. So I will call the coordinate, the spatial coordinate z. So we have a chain that lies along z axis, and then spins pointing this way and that way are preferred. So you can have a ground state where all spins point to the right, where all the potential energy terms would be zero. You can also have spins pointing to the left. That's another ground state, which again minimizes the potential energy.
What is the source of the easy axis?
It could be, for example, dipolar interactions. Dipolar interactions are long-ranged, and they prefer magnetization lined up with the longest axis of the body, right? So if you have a sphere, then in a sphere, you can have magnetization pointing in any direction and it'll be fine. But if you have a long cylinder, then magnetization prefers to lie in this direction because this magnetic moment will generate the magnetic field pointing in that direction, so its neighbors would like to do that. But if they orient themselves like this, the magnetic field of this spin will point up and then it'll turn back down, and so the spins will not be happy about this arrangement. So you end up having a preference for the direction this way and that way. And although this Hamiltonian, this potential energy is local, so it doesn't capture all of the physics of this particular anisotropy mechanism, it will be a good caricature for that. Okay. The nice feature of this model is that it's solvable in the sense that we will be able to write down closed form expressions for our solitons. So we'll be able to make progress, which is important for theorists, right? Okay, so now you can imagine building your magnet from two sides, and you have two graduate students, and you tell them to just put the magnet in the ground state. And they start doing that, and of course they screw up, right? So one builds a ground state that points this way, the other points the other way, right? And so rather than being disappointed in them, you say, oh, great, we have now something interesting here. We have a soliton or a nonlinear excitation where spins interpolate from one ground state to the other. It's okay to make mistakes. Sometimes you learn from them, right? And in fact, this is a very stable thing, right? You cannot just, by doing something locally here, kill this soliton, because In order to expunge it and get back to one or the other ground state, you would have to move the soliton all the way to the right or all the way to the left. In other words, you have to make changes in half of your system in order to get back to one of the ground states, right? So for instance, you have to flip all these spins and make them point to the right. So you'll have to make a lot of changes in your system. So for this reason, if you only make some local changes around the soliton, it'll stay there.
Are the lengths of spins assumed to be constant, or the magnitude of them?
Yes.
So do you add that in by hand, or shouldn't that be some term in the Lagrangian?
Well, so we write this Lagrangian under the assumption that the length is 1.
Right. But there should be like some term you could add to enforce that Lagrangian, right?
You can add the Lagrangian multiplier if you'd like. So you can add a term to the action that would be minus dz dt. M squared times whatever Lagrange multiplier. We can also do something else. We can express M in terms of two angles theta and phi. That takes care of the constraint, right? Which is why I did this yesterday in spherical coordinates. Or you can think that M is a vector that lives on the unit sphere and just use the calculus of that to take care of this constraint, okay? So it's implied. So this is a stable soliton, and this soliton will have a couple of coordinates that we call zero modes, or a couple of modes that we call zero modes that correspond to its position and its orientation, right? So if you look at this configuration, if you shift the soliton without changing its shape to the right, its energy presumably will not change, right? That comes from translational invariance in the system. It will also not affect the energy if you rotate the spins, and instead of pointing this way, they could, for example, point that way or this way. Right? So two of these symmetries will ensure the presence of these zero modes. Yes?
The M's can point in like all three dimensions.
So M is a three-dimensional vector, yes. It can have three components, X, Y, and Z. So in this case, the z component is special, but the x and y components are completely symmetric relative to each other, and so you can make rotations about the z-axis. Right? So we anticipate that a soliton like that, whatever its shape is, which we will calculate, will have a couple of interesting coordinates, which we will call z and phi, where z tells us where the soliton is located. Right? So this would be z. And the azimuthal angle that the spins take will be our second interesting coordinate. So Z represents the location of the soliton, right? So this, it's centered over here. And phi represents the orientation of spins on the soliton. Right. The spins here have no azimuthal angle because they point to the south pole or to the north pole, but the spins here have some direction in the azimuthal plane, and we'll deal with that right now. So I will write down just the potential energy because we're not going to discuss the dynamics initially. We'll just think about what the shape of the soliton is. So I will just write the potential energy of that, which I would like to write in spherical coordinates. Right, so I'll express M in terms of spherical angles, sine theta, cosine phi for the x component, sine theta, sine phi for the y component, and cosine theta for the z component. And so the exchange interaction, for instance, will be represented by the spatial derivative of theta squared and sine squared theta times the spatial derivative of phi squared. And then I will have a term that discourages spins from pointing to the equator, k over 2 times sine squared theta. So what I want to do is I want to minimize this with respect to both the phi field and the theta field. So minimizing with respect to theta will give you several terms here. So one of them would be, let's minimize first with respect to phi, actually. There's just a single term here that depends on phi. In fact, it depends on phi prime. So I'm going to have minus d dz here of a sine squared theta d phi dz. And so this should be 0. And now you can see that I can use a very simple solution for this, in which phi is just some number, doesn't depend on the position along the chain. So all spins share the same azimuthal angle. Right? So if they interpolate from the north pole to the south pole, they do so along a particular meridian like this, or maybe like that. Right? So all the spins lie in the same plane. And now I can minimize with respect to theta. So the first term comes from a theta prime squared over 2. So it'll be minus d dz of, d2 theta dz squared, basically, times a. Right. The second term will come from differentiating the sine squared. So you'll have plus a sine theta cosine theta times phi prime squared. But since phi prime is 0, we can drop this term right away. And then the easy axis anisotropy gives us one more term dependent on theta. So we have k sine theta cosine theta. Right. So this thing should be 0. So the resulting equation I can write as d2 theta dz squared equal to k over a sine theta cosine theta. And it's a second order differential equation. So it's not easy to solve. How does what come?
M. How does that
come? Well, so M is represented like this, right? And if you take, so how do I get from this to that?
The one below it.
The one below, right? So it's different. Let's minimize this energy with respect to angle theta. When you do this, right, so you differentiate the sine squared term. You also need to differentiate this. So if you take the variation of the term theta prime squared, let's just minimize this thing, right? So take its variation. You can write this as the integral dz theta prime twice times the change in theta prime, right? And then the second term will be plus sine theta cosine theta times d theta. So we'd like to write this out as something that is proportional to d theta. In this case, we have d theta. But in this case, we have d theta prime. So we have to integrate this term by parts to convert this to d theta. And then this will be converted to minus theta double prime. Okay, so that would be the integral d theta minus 2 theta double prime plus sine theta cosine theta times d theta. So this would be the derivative, the functional derivative of this expression with respect to angle theta. Right. So that's how I got this term and that term and that. All right, so what I need to do is solve this differential equation, which is second order in the spatial derivative. And there's a trick with which we can convert this to a first order differential equation. If you multiply both sides by d theta dz, you can now write both of them as a derivative, right? So it's d dz of d theta dz squared times a half. The right-hand side is also a derivative. This is the derivative of k over a sine squared theta. 1/2 also. And so now we can integrate this and obtain an expression that only has first derivatives. So what we will have is d theta dz squared equal to k over a sine squared theta plus a constant. Right? As we integrate, we'll also end up with a constant. So we need to figure out what this constant is, right? How do we figure this out? We look at some convenient place like infinity, where things ought to be simple, right? So we know that as z goes to infinity, our angle theta goes either to 0 or to pi, right? We're either at the north pole or at the south pole. And presumably by then, theta will stop changing. Theta prime would be 0. Right? We will have a uniform configuration where every spin points toward one of the poles. And in that case, both sides here and there would be 0. Right? So you will have 0 equal 0 plus c, so the constant vanishes. Okay. So we can now take the square root of this equation and obtain d theta dz equal to plus or minus the square root of k over a times sine theta. What is the meaning of the square root? Physically, what does it give us? Velocity? No. Gives us a length scale. See, on the left-hand side, we have z in the denominator. On the right-hand side, we don't, right? So it's a length scale. In fact, it's 1 over the length scale. I'll call it lambda. So lambda is a over k. What is the length, what is this, the length scale of? What does it tell us? It's the width of the soliton, right? It's the distance over which you interpolate from the south pole to the north pole. So it's the width of the domain wall. Right? So I can write my equation like this, d theta over sine theta equals plus or minus dz divided by lambda. So both sides are now dimensionless. And I can integrate this by multiplying both the numerator and the denominator by sine theta, and I will have minus d cosine theta over 1 minus cosine squared theta equal to plus or minus dz over lambda. And I can integrate both, so this will be 1/2 of the logarithm 1 minus cosine theta over 1 plus cosine theta equal to z minus capital Z divided by lambda. So the capital Z is the integration constant, and that's the number that characterizes where the soliton will be. And just one moment. The next expression will tell you. If you use straightforward algebra, the cosine theta as a function of coordinate z will have the following form. It'll be minus or plus, plus or minus has been lost here. The hyperbolic tangent of z minus capital Z divided by lambda. Is that now clear? So the hyperbolic tangent goes from minus 1 to plus 1 over a distance on the order of lambda. So you can have, here's the cosine theta, which is basically the height. Right? Plus 1 means the north pole, minus 1 means the south pole. And you can have a soliton that looks like this. Right? It goes between minus 1 and plus 1. And this is coordinate z. And the width is roughly lambda. So we've got our beautiful expression for the soliton. The cosine of theta is this. You can also write down solution for phi of z. That's just one number phi, which is a constant. Okay. So it's a soliton that does this or that, depending on which phi it has. Questions?
Yes. We still don't know how fast this propagates, right?
We don't. Okay. Well, so this solution is static, right?
Yes.
So it minimizes the energy. And if you write down the equations of motion, if it's static, then it satisfies the equations of motion. So what we found is a solution for a static soliton. Actually, I have one more board there, I think. So, we might ask the question about the dynamics of these solitons, right? So if we don't apply any external perturbation, then presumably they will be static. They will just not go anywhere. But we can apply an external force, push the soliton in some direction. We can also apply an external torque. We can try and twist it, right? After all, we have the angular variable here as well. So in a way, this resembles a bead on a string, right? So imagine a string, you place a bead on it, the bead can move along the string, that's the z coordinate. It can also rotate about the string, that's the phi coordinate. So this is a model of this domain wall. What happens if you push a bead along the string? It's going to move how? Uniformly, you apply a constant force. It's going to accelerate, right? If you twist it, what happens to it? It's going to speed up in the angular direction, right? Accelerate in the angular direction. Well, this soliton does not work like that. It works in a rather strange way. In fact, if you push it, it rotates. If you twist it, it moves. Why is that? We'll come to that. It behaves in this weird way because it's made out of what? Tiny little gyroscopes. Gyroscopes are weird, right? You made something out of gyroscopes, it's going to behave in a strange, strange way. And it does. Okay, so I can give you some heuristic arguments first that it should behave in this way, and then we'll derive it formally. How's that? Okay. So instead of asking what happens if you push it and what happens if you twist it, I can phrase this question slightly differently. What are the angular and linear momenta of a soliton? And what I'm going to show next is that the angular momentum let's call it JZ is, well, what do you expect it to be? What is the angular momentum of a bead? If it's spinning. Moment of inertia times angular frequency, right? I times omega. Not in this case. It's going to be a constant times the coordinate. Well, how can that happen? Well, here's how. Let's consider a soliton which is centered right in the middle of the ferromagnetic wire. Where does the angular momentum of a soliton come from? What are these arrows? They're spins. Spins are angular momentum. So each spin contributes a negative angular momentum along this direction here and a positive angular momentum there. So they compensate each other. The angular momentum in this configuration is zero. But now imagine I shift the soliton to the right. So I'm going to straighten this, make it something like that. What is the angular momentum of this soliton now? What is the sign of it? It's pointing that way, right? Negative. So that explains this. In fact, we can calculate the proportionality constant. It's going to be negative, right? Because you shift it to the right, you get more negative spins. And the proportionality constant is twice the density of angular momentum, or density of spin. Why twice? It's a double effect. You shorten one domain, you elongate the other.
Are you ignoring the spins of the soliton?
No, I'm not. In fact, instead of thinking what happens in the middle, you can think what happens at the edges. You're elongating one by adding stuff here. You're shortening the other by removing stuff there. You keep the soliton shape the same.
This little thing here is going to depend on the whole spin structure.
Yeah, we'll see that again in our formal calculation. So for now, this is just a heuristic argument. It should certainly raise some questions, and it's not very solid, I tell you. We'll do it in a different way, and we'll see that everything works out fine. This will give us the correct answers. In fact, the question of momenta, conserved momenta of a ferromagnet have been lingering for 40 years. And I just published a paper explaining how it works out. So if you're curious, I can give you a reference. But this is just a heuristic argument to start the conversation, okay? So if this is the angular momentum, then we can use the equations of motion. Right? So if you apply a torque, the torque does what? Increases angular momentum, right? So torque equals dJz dt. And jz is that. There we go. You apply a torque, the domain wall moves with a velocity proportional to the torque. Very strange. Well, so if you think about this, our configuration space of the soliton, which we restricted to two coordinates, z and phi, happens to be a phase space because z is the momentum conjugate to phi. right? What does it mean? It means in particular that you cannot measure simultaneously coordinate in its momentum. So phi and z cannot be measured simultaneously. There's the Heisenberg uncertainty relation that tells you that, right? So delta p phi times delta phi cannot be less than h bar over 2. And so if we use that definition of angular momentum, what we'll have is 2j times delta z times delta phi is not smaller than h bar over 2. So in other words, the product of uncertainties of the coordinate and the angle will be at least h bar divided by 4j.
Change into a quantum analysis. I mean, how does this come in?
Well, there are no purely classical systems, right? We're describing it in terms of classical systems. But all systems are quantum.
So I can think about the quantum aspects of this. That's what I'm doing now. So this is a scenic detour. It's not particularly important to what will happen next. But nonetheless, it's fun to think about this, right? So let's do that. In a model of a chain with spins of length h bar s and lattice constant a, the spin density is h bar s divided by a. So we can substitute this in here, and we'll obtain the delta z times delta phi would exceed a divided by 4s.
How do you know that the z and phi are related by
constant? Well, I just derived that the angular momentum is a constant times z. The angular momentum is conjugate to the angle. But I'm not doing it exactly in vain, in fact. So this sounds strange, but you know, these are quantum objects. They're spins. They fluctuate. And in fact, the uncertainties in the coordinate and the angle reflect these quantum fluctuations of spins on the soliton. What I'm doing this for is actually to turn this around. And you can think of this as a phase space, but in a different way, right? You can also say that z phi is a phase space with coordinate z and momentum pz. Right? They're canonically conjugate variables. So phi must be a linear momentum. So in fact, I will say that linear momentum is two spin densities times the angle. The coefficient of proportionality is the same. What's different is the sign. So you can justify it on various grounds, you know, by using, for instance, a construction in which if you know a coordinate, its momentum is minus ih bar d that coordinate, right? So you can kind of construct it from there. But let's just stipulate that this is the case. So the linear momentum of the soliton is not mass times velocity. There is no mass here, right? Spins don't possess inertia. Instead, it's the angle. You change the angle, momentum changes. Isn't that wonderful? It's periodic. That's a very good question. Yeah, and there are ramifications of that, but we don't have time to go into this. We can discuss that later. Yeah.
Even though, like, say, the system with one soliton isn't the global minima, it's a local minima?
So it's a very good question. Yeah, but, so the two ground states are absolute minima.
Right.
The solitons are
also absolute minima in their own topological sector. Right? You cannot use a local deformation to go from a soliton to a ground state.
So my question is, even though it's not the global minimum, would you still say it's a spontaneously broken
strand of the translational symmetry?
It does spontaneously break two symmetries, in fact. One is the translational and also the rotational one.
Right, so, but does that mean there's like quasi-particle associated stretching out the soliton?
No. Not the stretching of the soliton, but shifting.
Right.
So the shift costs zero energy. This is, you know, that's the same consequences for the Goldstone mode to have zero energy.
Yeah, but if you were looking at the particles which have an infinitesimal, you'd have to make the shift spatially dependent, so they'd be stretching out, right?
No. So the zero modes are the ones, so in the case of Goldstone modes, they have zero wave number. Right?
Well,
so they're uniform rotations.
I'm talking about excitations past that.
So you're thinking about excitations that cost slightly more than zero energy.
Arbitrarily small energy.
There are none.
Can't you stretch this all the time?
If you stretch it, you have to pay something. So in fact, you can analyze, you can ask a different question. You can think about excitation frequencies. And it turns out that you have two excitations that have exactly zero frequencies, and these are the shift and the rotation of the soliton. Well, other excitations have a finite frequency.
Yeah, so when we're talking about magnons, the spectrum also went to zero, but if you talk about excitation of non-zero energy,
there are no excitations that have a slightly non-zero energy.
It's gapped, right?
It's gapped.
Yeah.
But if I say the soliton is with lambda, and I take it to epsilon lambda, or 1 plus epsilon times lambda, then isn't that infinitesimal?
It's not an eigenmode. So it's not an eigenmode. If you study eigenmodes, then, which would be to say, if you're looking at small deviations from the soliton shape, right? So you can consider excitations on top of a soliton, spin waves on top of a soliton. You can find that there are two spin waves with exactly zero frequencies, and these are the translation and the rotation. All the other spin waves in the background of the soliton will have a finite frequency. The exact same gap as there would be in the uniform ferromagnet in this case. So we can discuss this after you guys solve was it tutorial or homework problem about this? I forget. The K problem. Homework. So we need to press on with the mechanics of our solidons, right? So good questions, but let's postpone that. Suppose this is the case. I'm still making an argument here which is heuristic. I haven't gotten to the formal stuff yet, right? Suppose this is correct. What are the consequences of this? Well, you apply a force, you generate a change in the momentum, and that means that the angle phi will advance. That's what I said, right? So you apply a force, it rotates. So it's another strange property of this domain wall. Yes?
When you write capital phi and lowercase phi, if they're equal, what is the difference when you're writing one rather than the other?
When I'm writing phi,
the
p phi?
Capital and lowercase phi. Because over here you said they're the same.
So I think they're all capital. So I'm talking about momenta here. So I just capitalize all of them.
No, but the phi.
The phi?
Yeah, why is it sometimes capital and sometimes not? If they're
The difference between little phi and capital phi is that phi is a function of z. It's a field that's defined everywhere in space. In principle, I can have spins pointing differently in the azimuthal direction at different points in space. In my soliton, or in the ground state, phi makes no difference because it points along the north or south direction anyway. But if I examine a soliton, it turns out that the angle phi is the same for all spins. So I call that value common to all spins capital phi. This is just a constant, okay, that characterizes the orientation of the soliton. So spins interpolate from this to that via some direction. And this direction could be like this or could be like that. So the difference between them is given by this azimuthal length. Okay.
Any further questions?
Here, when you talk about F, actually, it's not, you're talking about the force acting on the spin, right? It's like,
so I haven't explained how you apply a force to spins.
Right, yeah. So how do you apply a force not to the spins, but to the domain wall? I'm talking about a force applied to a domain wall. How do you apply a force to a domain wall? Well, here's how. Remember that these are magnetic moments. I'm going to apply a magnetic field pointing this way. What do these magnetic moments think about this field? Do they like it or do they not like it? Magnetic moments tend to be parallel to the field, right? They lower their energy. Remember, there is the interaction energy is minus mu dot H, right? So if the magnetic moment is parallel to the field, its energy goes down. So these guys are enjoying it. How about those ones? They're not, right? So their energy is positive. So what you naturally would love to do is shrink this domain and expand that domain. Which means that if you shift the domain wall to the left, you will have fewer spins pointing to the left and more spins pointing to the right. So instead of erasing this part and redrawing it, I'm just going to erase this and add a spin here. That's the construction I alluded to previously.
Under this magnetic field, isn't that the shape of the soliton? It's also
like the shape of the soliton does not matter because you see I haven't done anything to this part. The change only concerns lengthening and shortening of the straight parts.
What I'm doing is I'm applying a very weak field.
Right. We're making a very small perturbation, very weak perturbation, because we don't want to disturb the soliton. Okay. So the soliton will deform a little bit, but it's rigid enough for us to neglect that for weak fields. So it's doing something very perturbative. And normally, we would say small perturbations don't matter, except in this case where we have two zero modes. The zero modes are the modes where we shift the soliton, and in the absence of the field, it costs nothing. So these zero modes will be the first ones to respond and respond strongly, even to a weak perturbation. This is what we're doing. Right? So shifting the soliton to the left reduces the energy, right? It shortens the wrong domain and it lengthens the right domain. And so the energy changes in proportion to the shift. And if the energy is linearly proportional to the shift, what does it mean? There's a force, right? The force is the derivative of energy with respect to the displacement times the minus sign. And so there's a force pushing this domain wall in which direction? In that direction, right? Because you would like to get more of these spins. So by applying a magnetic field, you're pushing the domain wall in that direction. So we've figured out how to apply a force. If you forget all that and you just ask, what happens to a single spin if you apply a magnetic field? It processes, right? With a frequency proportional to the field. That frequency is known as the Larmor frequency. It's the gyromagnetic ratio times the field, and so it's proportional to the force. The stronger you push, the faster it rotates. So this is not just a fantasy. Okay? So what I've dreamed up here seems to be right. Okay? It's not that easy to think about applying a twist. If I have time at the end, I can tell you how you can apply a twist. But for now, I can tell you that it's possible. Right? You can apply a twist, and if I tell you how, you'll say, aha, yeah, the domain rule will shift. It will move.
Field, and you say the field applies force and the photon, and photon can move.
Right.
And so you apply force, and that changes the spin. Didn't you say that the
an individual spin would persist, right? These spins would not persist because they're parallel to the field, right? So there's no direction, there's nothing for them to do. But these spins, even though they're not free, presumably they will persist, right? Because this field applies a torque to them to go in a certain direction, and they will do that.
That equation, F is proportional to P phi
dt. Right, yeah. That's, so that was from some strange considerations. These are perhaps more familiar physical considerations.
So is the magnetic field makes the soliton accessible, like fiber?
Exactly, that's what it does, right?
But also moving in this direction.
No, you're pushing it. And according to our reasoning, it shouldn't move. It should just rotate in place. And that's precisely what it does. You push it, it rotates. You twist it, it moves.
But your argument was when the magnetic field was applied, like we want to get rid of the number of the anti-parallel cells.
That indicates we're applying a force. It doesn't mean that it moves. That thing shows that it should rotate, and it does rotate.
It was going to be a force because we argued that it should move.
No. We considered a virtual displacement.
And the virtual displacement showed that the energy should go down. Right? If the energy is conserved, then it shouldn't move, right? The Zeeman energy should stay the same, the interaction energy with magnetic field. So it'll just spin in place.
The photon, different part of them, the process frequency will be different.
The same. So in fact, if you consider a single spin, it doesn't matter which way it's tilted. The precession frequency is exactly the same. And in fact, if you calculate the precession frequency for this, it will be exactly the same as for an isolated spin, the Larmor frequency. So all this should tell you that it's actually something fundamental, okay? Because this complicated domain rule processes with the same frequency as a free spin. So somehow all this strange mechanics works very precisely. We're not fine-tuning anything, it just happens naturally. In fact, the exact shape of the domain rule does not matter in this case. It just matters that it interpolates from the south pole to the north pole.
If you couple this chain to a heat path, to like infinite temperature or something, and then you quench really quickly, Is there like a probability distribution for the number of solitons?
Yeah, there will be, exactly. You can do that, and you'll generate lots of solitons.
Wow.
But then they will start annihilating.
Okay. I'm just wondering if it would be more fair to create more solitons, or what's more likely to create fewer or more? If you did this like a lot of times, would you look at it and find, oh, there's a lot of solitons more often than not, or?
Yeah, there'll be a lot of solitons.
If the temperature is infinite, you know, the spins are completely disordered. And so as they cool down, they will form solitons, then the solitons will start annihilating.
Yes?
If the force is proportional to d phi over dt and phi is a constant, how does that work?
Sorry?
If phi is a constant, then, and you're taking the derivative.
No, phi is a constant in a static soliton. So we consider the soliton at rest without any external perturbations. And in such a soliton, phi is a constant. So now I'm arguing that if you apply additional perturbations on top of the energy that we already have considered, phi will not be constant. In fact, all of the spins will be simultaneously rotating. Okay? So the previous derivation where phi turned out to be a constant from minimization of energy did not take into account additional perturbations. And so I'm saying that if you apply some external perturbations, there will be some interesting dynamics. Right? So, shall we move on to the formal
stuff
and derive this? Okay.
Sorry?
Are you calling it salt time because it propagates without change in shape?
Without much change in shape, yes. So it, as long as it's rigid enough, a small perturbation is not expected to change its shape.
That's why you're fine. Yeah.
Right. All right. So now let's try and derive this in a more rigorous fashion. So we start with the Lagrangian of our system, which includes this kinetic term that depends on the velocity of the spins, and it has some potential energy that I've already written down, but I will not bother writing it out. Right? So this may contain the potential energy of the undisturbed part plus external perturbations like the magnetic field I applied or whatever else I might add, just a weak thing. Right? Let's say this is U0. And then some additional portions, right? This is the main part, just the easy axis ferromagnet, and these are perturbations. I'm going to change the description of my system, and instead of thinking of my soliton as a field spread out on space, I'm going to think about the most important details of most important features of the soliton. Right? You can imagine that if you hit your soliton, it will propagate. It might even change its width a little bit as it's moving, right, ringing in some sense. And there may be other twists appearing somewhere else. But for the most part, these will be really small changes in the shape of the soliton, as long as the perturbation is weak, right? So the two main features we will observe will be the shift of the soliton as a whole and the change in the azimuthal angle of the spins. Right? So these two coordinates, or collective coordinates, I should say, we have to watch carefully, right? Because these are the most important features. Plus, there may be other things, like the width might change a little bit, whatever. It might twist in this way that, you know, not all phis will be the same, something. So from this, I will switch to a new description in which I describe it in terms of what I call collective coordinates. So it's a set of numbers, such as the position, azimuthal angle, width, whatever else. So Q includes z, phi, lambda, whatever you want to include. Maybe everything. Maybe you describe every single detail. If you're an experimentalist, you probably won't bother with the rest of the stuff. You're just interested in this, right? And we'll take that position at the end of our calculation. But for now, I'm interested in including everything. So just describing it in terms of collective coordinates rather than the field. Is that a clear idea? And one other important thing is that the time dependence of this configuration comes through the time evolution of the collective coordinates. So I'm not saying that the spin here turns. I'm saying that the azimuthal angle of all spins rotates. Right? So all spins rotate, phi changes, or the whole soliton moves. And that's why spins change. Okay? So as long as I can tell what the collective coordinates are at this moment, I can describe the entire field from minus infinity to plus infinity. That's a second key idea. All right? And if I now adopt this viewpoint that M no longer depends on time itself, but only through the collective coordinates, then the time dependence, or the time derivative M dot, will be calculated as the partial derivative of M with respect to these collective coordinates times the collective coordinates velocities. Okay? And so now what I can do is I can rewrite my Lagrangian in the following way. So first of all, I'll have the potential energy that's presumably also described in terms of these collective coordinates. And the kinetic term we'll now have the following form. So it's A of M dot dm dqi integrated over space times qi dot. So if you examine this term, I can box this part and call it something else. Let's call it AI. And so my Lagrangian then looks like this. It starts with QI dot multiplying AI and then minus the potential energy, whatever that is, right? Now tell me, does this remind you of anything? The vector potential, right? The vector potential of a particle moving in a magnetic field. E r dot dot A minus potential energy, right? So we lack this piece. There's no inertia in spins, but this piece is clearly represented there. And we know even how to calculate this vector potential, right? So I've just given a recipe. This is what AI is. You just take the variation of magnetization in your soliton with respect to whatever collective coordinate you want. You've got the corresponding vector potential part.
I have a question. So the, for instance, Z and phi is determined by kind of solving the equation for a different boundary condition?
No. No. The boundary conditions were M becomes plus Z on that side. It becomes minus Z on that side. That does not fix either Z or phi. Right. So you have all the solitons with different Zs and different phis will satisfy the same boundary conditions. It's just a degree of freedom. Your soliton can be anywhere. It can have any orientation at once.
Relate those Z and phi to the R and T. I mean, well, if you know where the soliton is, suppose there are no other deformations, you know exactly what the field is like. Right? So you can translate the two numbers that I give you, capital Z, capital phi.
You can translate them into the exact configuration of the field, right? And if I give you a different lambda, you can still translate that into whatever configuration I have, right? So it gives you a complete description if you specify all the features of your soliton. Okay. So what we found here is our soliton behaves in a way reminiscent of a particle with no mass, but with an electric charge moving in the magnetic field. And it has some potential energy. So let's now simplify things and pretend that for a domain wall, such as this one for the soliton, we can only make do with two coordinates. So just keep Z and phi as collective coordinates. And neglect everything else. It should be okay as long as the perturbation is weak, because the width will not change if you have a weak perturbation. There will be no ripples on the soliton. It's too weak to cause them, right? And so we can just approximate the dynamics of the soliton by two collective coordinates that correspond to our zero modes, right? That cost ordinarily no energy. But if you apply an external perturbation, then there will be some energy associated with them. And so our Lagrangian then would be A z times z dot plus a phi times phi dot minus potential energy that's now a function of z and phi. So in fact, let me again split the potential energy into the part given by the ideal easy axis ferromagnet. And the part that comes from external perturbations. What can you say about this part? Suppose you are able to calculate it. What would be the result? Just a number, exactly. The energy of the soliton in the absence of external perturbations is independent of either z or phi. So we can just ignore this portion because it's a constant. So all of the potential energy comes from external perturbations in this case. That would not be the case if you included lambda, for instance, because the width change does change potential energy. So you can't ignore that. But here, just external perturbations affect the potential energy, right? Okay? So if we can calculate these numbers, the vector potential parts corresponding to z and phi will be in business. And we'll have our model. And we can solve it then. How's that? So let's calculate these things.
We change z and also we change the precession.
So we anticipate that z and phi will respond to the perturbation. The weaker the perturbation, the slower z and phi will change. Right? If the perturbation is completely absent, they're just constants. These erasers must be bosons. They like to bunch together. Okay, so let's think about the vector potentials. I will calculate AZ to begin with. AZ should be, according to my expression, it's the integral of A dot dm dz capital Z, and that's that, right? Okay. So here's my domain wall. If I shift it along the Z direction, what happens to the spins? They tilt, right? In which direction do they tilt? So here's my north pole, here's my south pole, and some spin points this way. As I move the domain wall, how will my spin move? Within this plane, right? So its angle phi will stay constant. So it'll move in the south or north direction. And I already have a designation for that, right? So for this spin, if this is the direction m, then the south direction here is going to be the unit vector that I called e theta. It's the unit vector that points along the meridian. So I know that dm dz is going to be proportional to e theta. So if I plug it in, I will have in that integral, A will be multiplied by E theta, which means that I'm taking the theta component of the vector potential. So now let's look up our vector potential that we had for the magnetic monopole. We had A theta equal to what? It was zero, right? And A phi was spin density cosine theta minus 1 divided by sine theta. So this thing just vanishes.
So there's no vector potential in the z direction. Well, let's calculate a phi. So it's the integral of a dotted with dm d phi integrated over z. So again, this is a spin. I change the azimuthal plane. What happens to the spin? Rotates this way, right? So all the spins are going to turn like that. The spins at the equator will turn the most. The spins near the poles will barely turn. Right? So their displacement would be proportional to the sine of angle theta. Sine theta 0, no displacement. Sine theta 0, no displacement. Sine theta 1, maximal displacement. So if I make a rotation angle delta phi, it will cause a change in m along the e phi direction, right? This is the direction east on the globe, multiplied by sine theta and delta phi. Agree? So in this way, I've calculated the derivative dm d phi. That would be sine theta and nothing else, right? So I have a phi, because I'm multiplying it with the unit vector in the phi direction, times sine theta, and I need to integrate it over z, over the entire chain, which I for now assume to be infinite. Well, let's plug in what a phi is. It's written over there. So it's going to be the spin density outside of the integral, cosine theta minus 1 over sine theta times sine theta dz. The sine theta cancels out. And I have the following expression. The cosine theta is the tanh, remember? So I have the integral of tanh z minus capital Z divided by lambda minus 1 integrated over z. So let me draw this for you. Tanh z minus capital Z divided by lambda minus 1. This is z. So it goes between minus 2 and 0, right? So on the left, it'll be minus 2. And then at some point, it'll interpolate between minus 2 and 0, like that. So I have to integrate this thing between minus infinity and infinity. What will happen? What will I get? Minus infinity, right? Bummer. What do we do? We got a nonsensical answer. A cutoff, a regularization, right? So we make the chain finite. Z goes between minus L and L. And so we integrate from here to here. Shall we do the integration? We could, but it'll be pretty painful. There is a way around that. Think of it, what happens if I shift my domain wall, and it'll look like this. I shifted by delta z. What's the difference between the areas? Two delta z, exactly, right? So I shift every single point here by the same amount. So you can split it into little rectangles, and then you can all, you know, stack them all together, and it'll be a nice rectangle with the width equal to delta z and the height equal to minus 2. So this regularization allows us to make a conclusion that this integral would be a constant that depends on L and lambda minus 2j times z. And if L is too small, then we might run into this cutoff, right, without reaching 0 or minus 2, which would be sad. So we have to take L as large as possible, much farther away from the soliton than lambda. So anyway, this is the result. We're not interested in these details, even though it diverges with L. We're interested in it as a function of z. This is not a dynamical variable. That's just some construction, right? So we're interested in the z dependence. So the z dependence is right there. Good. So now we know everything. And we can write down our Lagrangian and finally obtain the dynamics of our soliton. There'll be some exponential dependence, right? So something of order minus L divided by lambda or something like that. Independent of z.
I mean, if when we talk about A applied, like when we actually when we differentiate M with respect to the raw spy, like we use the argument to get away the calculation. So can you say that it is actually equal?
Well, so this is phi independent, right?
And when we do the differentiation, we make it from a constant factor.
A constant factor from what?
Dm d phi. Is it actually equal to the A of phi?
So dm d phi is the proportionality constant between this and that, right? So it's just that e phi times something. You multiply A on that, you get A phi times sine theta. Yeah, there were no approximations here. Okay. So let's write out the Lagrangian. It's AZ, we've just calculated, it was 0. A phi is minus 2 JZ, so it multiplies phi dot. And then we have some perturbation potential energy. And let's say the perturbation potential energy would be minus external force times the coordinate minus external torque times phi, right? So that corresponds to a constant force and a constant torque. So somehow I managed to apply a constant force, probably by applying a magnetic field. Somehow I managed to twist with torque tau, and that's what will happen, right? So I'll have minus 2j z phi dot plus fz plus tau phi. It remains to use the Euler Lagrange equations to find what the dynamics will be. Right, so the z part would be, as usual, ddt dld z dot minus dld z equal to 0, right? So ddt, so there's no z dot part, right? So that part is absent, so it's all minus dld z. So we'll have minus f and minus 2jz, 2j phi dot equal to 0. Just differentiate with respect to z, and both of these terms contribute. And that's precisely what we reasoned, right? You apply a force, it processes. The phi part goes in the same way. Differentiate with respect to phi dot, it's this part. So we'll have 2j z dot, right? So we differentiate with respect to phi dot, and then differentiate with respect to time, whatever remains from that differentiation, and that's 2jz dot minus dldz, that comes from
dl d phi, that gives you minus tau equal to zero. You apply a torque, it moves. So you can reason informally, you can reason formally, you get the same answer. And that, in fact, is how solitons move.
Okay.
So I think I'm pressed to stop at this point. It's already 12:15. But as you leave the room, I'm going to show you another kind of soliton. So feel free to move around. This is the rotational degree of freedom, right? That's the azimuthal angle of all spins processing together. And this is the translational degree of freedom. That's z changing or x, whatever it is here, right? So that's a domain wall. Let me show you a vortex. This is a vortex, all right? The one at the center with the black dot. You have spins pointing in all directions around it. So this is a vortex soliton. In fact, the black dot and the white circle signifies that the spins at the center are pointing toward you, right? Because at the center, they don't know where else to point. And if they have no place in the plane, they have to point out of the plane or into the plane, which turns out to be extremely important. So the dynamics of vortices turns out to be equally weird. How many soft modes do you think there are here?
What are the soft modes? What are the zero modes?
2D translation.
Translational, right? So it breaks the translational symmetry in both directions. So x and y, positions of the vortex core, the center, will be your two collective coordinates that you can never ignore, right? What do you think is the momentum conjugate to the coordinate x? Make a wild guess. Coordinate y, yes. So this time, x and y turn out to be canonically conjugate to each other. And you cannot measure them simultaneously. If you know x well, then y is not well defined, and vice versa. And you can calculate the uncertainty in that. So if you push a vortex this way, what's going to happen to it? It's not going to accelerate in this direction, can it? It will move up or down. Which way? That's actually determined by whether the magnetization points out this way or this way at the core. So it works like a charge in a magnetic field. Imagine there's a magnetic field pointing this way. If you push the charge this way, it will have to have a velocity that way in order to have the Lorentz force pushing that way. Okay? So you can think in these terms.
What about the inversion with respect to the thing? Is that also a soft mode? Or it's a...
Well, it's a discrete symmetry, right?
Yeah, okay.
Not a continuous one.
Are they different topological sectors?
Yeah, they're different topological sectors. In more than one way, in fact. The winding number that you measure far away from this thing, and also how much of the sphere this thing covers. So this thing covers half of the sphere because the spin at the center points to the North Pole. Spins far away point to the equator, and in between they interpolate, covering the entire northern hemisphere. Right. This, the winding number on the sphere is referred to as the Skirmian number in this business. So this Skirmian number would be plus half, and if it pointed the other way, it would be minus half. It turns out it's the Skirmian number that determines the sign of these constants. So whether it goes up as you push it this way or down is determined by that. Okay, so I'll leave you with this. And if you have any further questions, feel free to ask me now. I will also be in my office during the afternoon, so feel free to stop by. It's number 272.
Is it possible to have more than one scrimion? Because the domain would incur like a huge penalty, right? Opposite
orientation. Let me show you a scrimion.
It would be like.
Skirmion. Wait.